joint session of the House and the Senate Resources Committee will come to order. Time is 12:10. For the House members, we delayed the start of the meeting 10 minutes based on the session of the Senate. Sorry about that. At this point in time, from the Senate, we have Senator Stedman and Huggins. Others to follow. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President, and we always start on time, so it's 12 o'clock House time. Representative Rosas, Edgman, Seaton, Wilson, Kawasaki are present. Representative Gatto, co-chair, will be here shortly.
Okie doke. Today, our task essentially is to give the mining industry an opportunity to speak to us. In the beginning, we will do a review of major mining projects by Steve Burrell, and then we will go to taxation of the industry, and finally to Donlin Creek. And without further ado, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chairman of the House also, members of the committees. Thank you very much for this opportunity. We very much appreciate it to come down and share with you what's going on. I'll suggest you look up there. This is the agenda that I believe you have right now in front of you, pieces that we're going to be talking about. First, I'll start off talking a little bit about placer mining in particular. The placer operators, there are approximately 70 mines operating in the state. We expect that to continue in 2007. Various others are permitted and have not haven't been mining in the past couple years, but may indeed start up again. The production from placer mining averages about 25,000 ounces per year all around the state. This is a Senator Huggins, in your district, Valdez Creek Mine operated for about 8 or 10 years. It was at the time the largest private employer in the Mat-Su Borough. And the picture you see there is how it looks today after reclamation closure, with a deep water reservoir, a deep water lake there with fresh water running in and out of it all the time, providing a new kind of fishery in that area. The pictures don't show very well, and maybe I can show them with the pointer, but going to talk through the mines, and both the producing mines, the development projects, and then some other things here today. But in the order of when they began operation, the first one would be Usabelli Coal Mine, which is about right here, followed by, in 1989, Greens Creek, large underground polymetallic mine across from Juneau, across on Admiralty Island. Also in 1989, Red Dog Mine up in this portion of the state on Nana Regional Corporation lands operated by Teck Cominco, Alaska. The next mine to open up was Fort Knox at Fairbanks, a large open pit gold mine. Then Pogo, just this past year, February 12th of 2006, where they had their first gold pour at Pogo over near Delta Junction. And the other major operating mine, Nixon Fork, which had operated for several years out near McGrath, is today back in operation with, I think it's 85 people on site out there as we speak. Nixon Fork operated for several years. It was shut down and then restarted. The development projects, again, in order of either construction or possible development for those that are not yet in construction, down here at Juneau, north of Juneau on Berners Bay, Kensington project, at Nome, the Rock Creek project, just outside of Nome, and then Chewitna Coal, which is directly west of Anchorage across Cook Inlet, followed by Donlin Creek, which you'll hear much more about later, and the Pebble Project just north of Lake Iliamna. Usabelli Coal Mine, been in operation now going on its 64th year. Now, what do I do, Carl, to get rid of that? What you see in the picture is the drag line. You see the blast hole drill off here to the side, and then the bulldozer creating grade for the drag line to work. Usabelli Coal Mine, 95 employees, 100% Alaska hire. producing right at 1.5 million tons a year. Some years it's slightly more, some years slightly less. Coal production goes both to the interior Alaska power plants, but also to Korea, and for the last 2 years, and again this year to Chile. They have operated nearly 1 year without a lost time accident.
Yes, Steve, before you go any further, let me just mention to the audience that one of the things we're looking at to make Agrium work is Usabelli coal in the logistics of that. Excuse me, thanks.
Okay, sure. Greens Creek, the polymetallic mine across on Admiralty Island. What you see is a, of course, aerial view of the facilities. The actual portal is right there across the bridge. The portal is there, and the mining is occurring way off the screen and way, way down below to the right from this picture. In the picture, you see the coarse ore stockpile. You see the mill, the generator plant, which is right here. That generator is sitting idle today because the intertie from attaching it to the Juno intertie system is in place, and this mine is now going to allow the AELMP to create the to build the new Dorothy Lake power plant because of this added demand. And of course, here's the shop, office, warehouse facility over here. Greens Creek Statistics, largest private sector employer in Southeast Alaska with 294 employees. 63 of those live in Juneau per se. 81% are Alaska residents. Economic impact, $24 million in wages and benefits, and another $20 million in annual local supplies and services contracted. Here is a picture of one of the pieces of equipment from Greens Creek for your reference. That is a fellow standing right there. That's the operator. We're talking some very large equipment. This is a roof bolter, roof and ribs and everything else. It's these long bolts that go off into the roof that hold the structure so it doesn't fall, so it doesn't cave in, protects the people that way. Here's a picture of the loadout at Greens Creek. You see the concentrate storage barn right here and a conveyor which loads into the ships. The original cannery that had been there for many, many decades, that's it. Here's the dock that went out for the cannery dock. This dormitory, incidentally, several years ago when the timber industry was in extreme dire straits, the issue was whether or not some of the people from the timber industry could be trained and get jobs at the mine. And in particular, that facility was constructed to allow some people to be able to live on site and working a shift rotation. Red Dog Mine, zinc mine, zinc and lead on Nana Regional Corporation lands, Northwest Arctic. In the distance, that strip right there is now the paved runway. Of course, Alaska Airlines, we assume they go everywhere. Well, they go everywhere. You have a paved runway now. They no longer have the aircraft that will that can land on gravel. And so here, I believe it was a year and a half ago, they paved that runway. Some of the details, statistics from Red Dog, 450 employees, 56% are NANA shareholders, 37.7 million annual wages and benefits, and another 37.6 million for 13 NANA joint venture contractors. One of the major projects coming up this next year, a couple of construction projects, but in addition, they expect to expend $9 million drilling for natural gas. One of their major, major cost items at the mine site is energy, and if they can find natural gas on their own lands in that area, much to their benefit. This picture doesn't show up real well, but this is Red Dog Creek before mining ever took place. And the redness you see is natural acid rock drainage. It was that stain, that red material that Mr. Baker, the pilot, saw, told some geologists about it. They came out and investigated it, and lo and behold, that was the discovery of Red Dog. That's what it looked like before man was involved in the area. Periodically, rainstorms would flush that acidic water downstream, killing fish for several miles. And today, this is what the stream looks like below the mine site, cleaned up. Fort Knox open pit, large open pit gold mine at Fairbanks. In the distance, you see the actual pit itself. Right here is the shop. That's the shop. This end is the office and warehouse. And the mill facility is in this area. This area you see down below are the tailings. There's the tailings impoundment. Some Fort Knox statistics: 400 employees, 39 million annual wages and benefits. In 2006, they produced 333,000 ounces of gold. They also worked over 1 million man hours in those 4 years without a lost time accident. There you see a large EX3600 shovel loading 190 ton trucks. Ogo, the most recent large mine other than Nixon Fork, but Pogo began operating, as we said, a year ago in February. This is looking to the east. This is the Good Pasture River. The original facilities are off the page. The original portal, 1525 portal, where they did the original exploration work is over here off the page. Here is the new airstrip that's in place, 3,000-foot airstrip. The mill facility, the camping shop, the dry stack tailings up here above the site, and then the two additional new portals right here in this area. A picture from underground at Pogo. The first gold pour, as I said, was February 2006. They are ramping up right now, and in the dark there, it's May of this year. They expect to be to full production. 2007, the target level of production is 340,000 ounces. Looking inside the mill at Pogo, modern mill, the control center over here on this side, the operator sits there with several computer screens in front of him, and from that location, the operator can turn pumps on, turn them off, he can change the flow levels, he can shut down one part of the system, operate another, he can watch the temperatures, for example, on the solutions, he can watch the temperatures on major bearings, all controlled from one location, and of course he has full-time discussion ability right on directly through radio system with the mechanics that may be out walking around working in the mill. Nixon Fork Mine out near McGrath resumed operation in November 2006. They have 86 employees on site right now, 90% Alaska hire, the annual payroll of $5.9 million, and greater than $1 million of annual contract expenses, plus I can't even read what the others are, $4.8 million in annual supplies. And during the past 4 years, they've been in construction to rebuild the mine site, but also exploration work. And during that period, there have been no lost time accidents. In the picture, you see their tailings impoundment right here. Line tailings facility. Here's the shop and the mill facility. There's the camp, and then this is the airstrip off the side. They have a 4,000 plus foot airstrip that you can land Hercules or DC-6 class aircraft. Kensington Project, just north of Juneau here, up on Berners Bay. Off in the distance, you can see where Haines is. This ridge, the mine, the ore body is actually located just across this ridge on the other side, but the facilities are being built here in this valley. Crews will be brought across across Berners Bay in a boat, go up by a bus up to the work site, and there is a tunnel being driven right now through that mountain, 6,800 foot tunnel. They expect to join the two sides of that tunnel in July of this year, connect up the two sides. Here's a picture from just a week ago of the facilities in construction right now. 60 permits in hand to build the mine. It's in construction. 416 employees are right now on site. They do have a camp facility on site now because of the construction. During operation, they don't expect to have people living on the site. They'll have 200 employees when it is in production with 16 million annual wages and benefits. This is fairly dark, but this is inside the mill. It's under construction right now. Rock Creek at Nome, also a mine under construction. This is it's on lands, a combination of private lands and Bering Straits Native Corporation and Sitnasauk Village Corporation lands. The expected capital cost is $78 million. To date, they've spent $66.4 million, 135 employees, one in operation, and that's actually the number right at 135. They're on site right now doing the construction, putting the project together. Annual payroll of $10.4 million and $20.6 million supplies and services annually. This is a picture from like a week and a half ago of the mill under construction. You see the foundations and everything being poured there. They have poured concrete down to as low as 25 below zero, and obviously it's fully enclosed when they do that. Chewett and Nicole, directly across Cook Inlet from Anchorage, about 55 miles. They expect to have a supplemental EIS completed by the fall of this year. They had an EIS complete 15 years ago, but the price of coal went so bad that they no way they could continue. The result was that it's been sitting, and now is its time and ability, because of coal prices, to start up again. They'll do a supplemental EIS. This particular block, this little circle around here, has 300 million tons of coal in that part alone. They expect a mine that will have a capacity of 12 million tons per year. The site will also have shop, office, and a camp. It is a camp facility, camp operated with crews, you know, like on the slope, but obviously closer to Anchorage. There are a couple different routes shown on here. It hasn't been settled exactly which the preferred route will be to get to the coast, but basically a 12-mile road and a 12-mile conveyor belt running together with an export terminal and a trestle going out about 10,000 feet into Cook Inlet in order to load what we call Cape-class vessels that have a draw of up to 60 feet. Dahlin Creek Project expanded up to 150-man camp this past year, and you'll have other folks who'll talk more about what all that means and what's what it takes to pull off a project like that. Dahlin Creek has today 8 drills are now operating, a budget this year of $87 million as compared to 2006 of $55 million. They expect to continue their feasibility level engineering, complete a feasibility study by November of this year, and prepare for final permitting and application and their environmental impact statement, which would begin somewhere after that. In 2006, they drilled over 300,000 feet of drilling, plus the environmental and engineering studies, without any lost time injuries. This is an exciting slide, and they'll be talking about this later, but the Dahlin Creek Project has employed people from all these villages with a larger dot, and 23 villages throughout the region have had people working at the project site at some time, and for an area with very little opportunity for business development and for jobs, this is really significant. Pebble Project, there you see one of the drills enclosed around it, of course, for the cold weather. Some of the Pebble statistics, $128 million invested to date. In 2006, they had 4 deep drills, and by deep, I mean they can drill to a depth of 6,000 feet. They expect to bring, have 8 of those drills this year. In the region, over 700 persons last year worked on the project at some point, including more than 50 different contractors. 70% of all employees were Alaska hire. 125 were residents of the Bristol Bay area. 15 villages represented last year at some part during the project. In 2007, as I said, 8 deep drills operating. They expect to have continued work on environmental and baseline studies and continued engineering studies. And in the picture, you see a helicopter. All the drill moves in the normal pattern for most projects is to have a small bulldozer and to pull the drill rig from site to site at Pebble. From the start, they have moved them by helicopter. And that's the end of my portion. At this time, I'd like to invite Carl Hahnemann up. Carl.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the invitation to come share with you a perspective on the mineral industry taxation. But before I begin, I'd just like to say that Lorna Shaw, who is the president of AMREF, which is Alaska Minerals and Education Resource Education Fund, has put an AMREF education kit and some materials over on the table for you. And as one of her board members, she asked me to invite you to look at that after the session. And of course, legislative support for the industry government partnership, which is the AMREF education program, is a very important aspect, and we appreciate your support for that AMREF program.
Carl, excuse me for one moment. We've been joined by Senator Wilkowski, Senator McGuire, and Senator Stevens. And if you would put yourself on the record and your affiliation and continue.
Certainly, thank you. My name is Carl Hahnemann. I am currently a manager of public environmental affairs and special project for TechPogo, gold mine in interior Alaska. And I'm also presenting to you today as president of the Council of Alaska Producers, which is the consortium of the major mining operations in the state. So what I'd like to do today is just summarize our perspective about mineral industry taxation. Quick summary of course, in addition to local contributions and corporate income tax, we have the state mining license tax, which was a significant component of our resource policy at statehood. It has been amended a couple times since statehood, and it provides for a 7% net profits tax on major operations payable from all operations in the state, regardless of land status or mineral ownership.
Carl, would you go back on that slide very quickly? You know, we have an ongoing debate mentally in the state about net versus gross tax, and you had the term net. How long has the net tax been in effect?
The net tax has been in effect, originally 1913, the territorial legislature imposed it, but it has been in effect since statehood.
Okay. Mr. Chairman? Thank you. I'm sorry, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious if we could have him elaborate on his definition of net. Clearly, you know, we've all looked and worked on for quite a while on that oil tax, where there's a lot of deductions before you're allowed to get to net. So it's a little different than a normal business income statement or profit and loss statement calculation. And I'm just wondering how this compares to that.
Well, I don't know for sure how you characterize it being different than the state of Alaska mining license tax return provides for a depreciation schedule that is consistent with the federal schedule. It provides for a deduction of expenses, operating expenses. It also provides for either cost or percentage depletion. And it's a one-year look at the operating cash flow of the operation. So that is, there's no carry forward losses nor carry back. It's quite transparent. It's and quite simple from an accounting standpoint to prepare or audit.
So yes. I think it's substantially different from the way the oil tax net is structured.
Right. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, in order to really get my hands on this, I would like to know if it was a gross tax and gave us the same amount of money as the 7% net profits tax, what would the tax on gross be?
Well, the objective of a net profits tax, and in the original development of this policy, was to provide for a tax that responded to the health of the industry as the industry's own health varies based on world market prices. So in order to give you an answer, you'd have to pick a certain point in time with certain prices and profitability of the operations, and then you could back calculate what a gross tax would be.
Yeah, Carl, if you could, when you get access to a calculator and some statistics, if you could just give some feedback on a couple of sites, that would.
Well, I have some slides later which will kind of put some of this into perspective with respect to the scale and scope of both the mining industry and other industries.
Yeah,
but it's a good question. And
Carl, one question for you on the concept of mining and profit loss. I've heard it characterized by some that the profit margin in mining is relatively small. Is that accurate, or how would you portray the profit margin on mining activities as we know them in Alaska?
Yeah, I mean, I began my career in the mining industry in 1979 after graduating from the University of Alaska. You know, since that time, it is factual that the return on equity for mining operations is characteristically low versus other employments of capital, whether it's telecommunications or oil and gas or something else. And I'm not particularly proud of that fact, but that is a fact. Now, commodity prices have increased significantly in the last couple of years, and worldwide mining operations and particularly integrated mining operations that rely on a number of different commodities are in some cases doing very well.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed. While Carl is working technically here, it's the intention of the chair that we will adjourn at approximately 1:15.
Okay. Another component of the payments and taxes to the state then is the rents on mining claims and royalties off of state leases, both coal and hard rock minerals. And this, the mining rents and royalties arose out of a policy debate that began in 1981 when the state AG questioned whether the state was getting adequate return from development and production of its resources, the quote, 6I section of the Statehood Act. And so the legislature, working with the industry in 1981 and 82, tried a modification of the policy with respect to taxation for rents and royalties. That resulted in a challenge litigation that proceeded through 1983, 1987. Many years of litigation ultimately went to the Alaska Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court found that yes, in fact, the state must charge either rents or royalties in addition to the mining license tax from production from state land. So in 1989 then, working with the industry and with the groups that brought the litigation, we essentially reached a compromise which imposed both rents and royalties, kind of a belt and suspenders approach, but one that was developed in a consensus building process that ultimately went through the legislature. And this provides then for rents up to $3.30 per acre per year, as well as an additional royalty of 3% net profits. It applies only to state land. But and here's a key point, is it this debate and resolution of the issue did occur prior to major industry expansion. So it set the groundwork that allowed that expansion, but established a sound policy, fiscal policy, so that the industry could understand the terms under which they would be investing. If we look then at the history of mineral production in Alaska in terms of a cumulative value of the production, we see in the early years here, 81 through 89, we had the coal mine, placer gold mining, sand and gravel, relatively constant at about $200 million a year. Then with Red Dog and Greens Creek coming on in 89, we see an increase here and then relatively stable for a few years until Fort Knox come into production. And then the increase in the last couple of years has been not from addition of new operations, but from the increase in the world commodity prices. Down the lower right-hand corner, I also show what the production is from state lands. And that shows relatively constant here at this $200 million level. So the increases that we've experienced over the years has been a result of production from federal or private lands, native lands. If we look at the value of the mineral production by commodities, we see that zinc is the largest one by far. Zinc is, of course, produced both at Greens Creek here, Admiralty Island, and at Red Dog. Greens Creek also produces gold. Fort Knox came in and produced gold. So gold and zinc are the major drivers of our mineral industry at this point. And historically, looking at the prices of those commodities, Red Dog and Greens Creek began in 1989, and here are the prices for zinc. When they went into production, many years, over a decade of low, depressed zinc prices. The mines were not doing well, but they were hanging on. There was a period of time when Greens Creek did shut down for a couple of years. Similarly, at Fort Knox began in 1996. Gold price went down. There was a long period of time where they had a tough time, had several capital write-downs. Commodity prices then, subsequent to this 2005, have risen even further off of this chart and are now well above the feasibility levels. And I'll show you later how this reflects into the tax payments then to the state. But it takes a long-term perspective for this to work for the mining industry. Red Dog started construction in 1986. It's a company I work for, Tech Cominco. Just this February, a couple weeks ago, 21 years later, they have now announced that for the first time, a full capital recovery, including interest factor, as of the end of 2006. And at Pogo, our production in 2006 began 15 years after our partners Sumitomo began exploration. If we look here at a chart, this is the cumulative kind of net investment in the Pogo project. Originally, of course, low expenditures per year during the exploration phase. I joined the project at Pogo in this period where we were doing environmental study, feasibility study, permitting, increased annual expenditures up until you make a decision point to construct the mine. Very large expenditures then. Now we're transitioning to production. We are producing gold. We have not yet reached commercial production, but this curve will turn around. We hope that it will not be a decade before we cross this line, but it has been nonetheless more than a decade since our substantive investment began. But with the increasing commodity prices recently, then we can see how this translates into increased payments. The bottom portion of this chart here is payments to municipalities. It's relatively stable. They're not generally based on commodity prices. Often a property tax type or something that reflects a payment in lieu of a property tax. Provides good local income, a stable base for those municipalities, which is something as a small government, they need to rely on the stability of that cash flow. Then the next smaller increment here is state rents and royalties. from coal and rents from the mining claims. And the upper segment here is the state mining license and income tax, showing as the commodity prices increased, we're getting a rapid percentage year-over-year increase in payments to the state. And as these numbers come in for 2006, we'll see another substantive increase there. Payments as well. One mine, the Fort Knox mine, is on Alaska Mental Health Trust land, and this shows then the increase 2004 to 2005 in terms of payments to Mental Health Trust. So if we look at this kind of payments with respect to cash flow or net return to the state of Alaska, this is taken from a Department of Commerce report, almost a year old now. Looks at four industries: timber, tourism, minerals, and commercial fish. And the left-hand column is total revenues to the state from that industry in millions of dollars, you can see over here on the left. The next column is total uses. That's how the report defined the term, uses being support, expenditures in support of that industry, all kind of either regulatory programs or resource management programs. And then the white or the farthest right column is the net return to the state as defined by this report then for each of these industries. Mineral, of course, is in the middle here Well, it's a smaller revenue, but very small kind of operating cost from the state standpoint, and yielding a reasonable net compared to the other industries. But I know that some members here have asked us about, well, are the payments to the municipalities really relevant and are they significant? And so I prepared this chart using the same data and the same report, but changing the definition of uses to include the state sharing of the fish tax that goes back to the municipalities, and it shows when that sharing does occur. Again, the mineral industry is paying a reasonable share compared to other industries. We can look then also at the value of the total value of the industry, you know, tourism, minerals, commercial fish. This data comes from this report, and this includes then the value of processing the minerals, like at the Red Dog Mill, processing them for export. It then also includes the value of processing fish at either shore-based or offshore processors for export. So, and taking those numbers then from the report, this gives the gross value of these industries. Commercial fish, of course, is the largest, tourism next, minerals down here just a little bit over $1.5 billion. And the net return as a percent of the gross value of the industry then is these intermediate columns here by the various industries. And Representative Gatto, then, with respect to the percentages, you know, that this is as close to an answer as I give you based on the data that was presented in FY05. But we believe that report missed the rentals that are paid by the mining industry to the state. And when you look at the 2005 calendar year data as opposed to FY05 data, pulling that information from the DGGS Special Report 60, you get then the here's the same chart with the same gross value of the industries and the net return to the state as a percent of that gross value on the intermediate columns. But one of the real exciting things, just from a industry potential standpoint, is the payments that are currently being made to NANA, the regional corporation in the area and owner of the Red Dog Mine. $185 million paid total since 1989, and we can see those payments then increasing substantially in the last couple years, with the column to the right being the distributions that result to other Native corporations through the 7i sharing. And so this, we believe that the mining industry really offers a potential to support economic development in diverse areas of Alaska, and in particular through this type of a revenue sharing standpoint. The benefit will be much broader than just the local to the project area. So in summary then, the mining industry, we can be regionally significant, provide private sector economic opportunity in rural and urban areas, but we'll never compare to the magnitude of oil and gas. I mean, our total annual output, total value at Pogo next year equals 5 days of TAPS output. You know, that from a, you know, as we plan ahead and look ahead toward, you know, revenue issues for the state of Alaska, we'll do our share, but we can't, we can't carry the load. But we do pay our fair share to the state compared to other industries. We pay taxes on profits from mining in Alaska, wherever the minerals are extracted, whether it's on state, federal, or private land. And our tax payments are rising, commensurate with rising world commodity prices. We've demonstrated that the existing tax regime is transparent, it's working as envisioned. And we need such a stable fiscal and regulatory policy moving forward so we can continue to attract the capital to allow this industry to reach its potential and contribute to Alaska. So thank you very much, and I will now introduce Stan Fu, who is the Alaska manager of Barrick Gold. He has been involved in the Donald Creek project since beginning in 1997, and he'll introduce the speakers.
Yep. Carl, 1 second. Question from Senator Wagner.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm late. Sorry if I missed
Senator Wagner joined us 10 minutes ago.
Pardon.
Go ahead.
You made a statement that the mining industry pays its fair share of taxes. How long has it been since there's been any change in the tax structure that's currently in place in Alaska?
I believe it was when the rents and royalties issue was resolved in 1989 with that legislative solution to impose both the rents and royalties. And other than regulatory adjustments to the rent issue to account for index for inflation.
One other question. And I realize that mining can never pay the revenues to the state that oil and gas does, but why did you make a comparison to the fishing industry, tourism industry, and what was the third one?
Timber.
Timber, and not to the state's leading producer of revenues. Why did you omit oil and gas from your charts when you made the comparison?
I was relying on this report that was prepared by the Department of Commerce, but more importantly, I think the mining industry is more akin to those other industries, resource extraction, you know, whether it's tourism or commercial fish or timber or mining. I mean, I think we have more similarities with those industries than we do to the scope and scale and kind of the worldwide or historical capital recovery rates in the oil industry. We are not akin to the oil industry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wilkowski, we have 45 seconds.
Okay, thank you. Two questions. What were the net profits made by the mining industry last year, and how much in total revenues were there? What percent of the net profits is that? If you know.
I don't have those that data compiled. The 2006 returns are not due to the state of Alaska till the end of April 2007. And so I you know, I'm not privy certainly to the financial.
Or we anticipate at the end of April you'll get those to us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I think good information and current information is crucial to sound policy development. I think this kind of report needs to be updated and compiled by the people most capable of doing it, which is the state government, not.
You know. Moving right along. Next speaker. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Give us your name and your affiliation, please.
My name is Stan Fu. I'm the Alaska manager for Barrick Gold Corporation in Alaska. I'm based in Anchorage. I live in Eagle River, Alaska. I'm also the project manager for the Dahlin Creek Project. I'd like to thank the chairman and committee members for their interest in the mining industry and in our project. And I'd like to thank Steve Burrell of AMA and Carl Hahnemann of the Producers Council for inviting us to provide an update specifically on our workforce development at Dahlin Creek. Dahlin Creek Project is located in the YK region. The nearest village is Crooked Creek, which is located on the Kuskokwim River. You see the project location here is highlighted. The village of Crooked Creek is just about 15 miles straight line from the project towards the river. Today we are here to review the progress we've made with our workforce development. And it is my pleasure to introduce members of our project team who have been directly involved in that. All of the people who will be speaking to you have been involved with the project longer than I have, and back to 1995, 1996, when at that time Placer Dome began working on the project. Placer Dome has since been taken over by Barrick, and Barrick has continued those local hiring efforts. The speakers will be George Gardner, who is president of Chulista Camp Services Incorporated. It is a subsidiary of the Chulista Corporation on whose land we are operating. It is private land under ANCSA. Bill Bieber is Barrick's operations manager at Dahlin Creek. He oversees all of the activities that go on to support our drilling and engineering studies on the site. Once again, this is an advanced exploration project. We are not yet a mine. We look towards completing our feasibility study by November of this year, and then following through with submission of our permit applications to work towards a mine. Additional speakers who will be available to address questions and share their experiences are Wasley Kamaroff and Leonard Martin.
Could you stand up when you're introduced so we can recognize who you are? Oh, very good, very good. And thank you for coming. We appreciate it very much.
Mr. Morgan and Mr. Kamaroff are our shareholder hire coordinators, and they have been directly involved in developing our workforce for the past 10 years since we've been involved in the project. My role in this is brief, and I'll turn it over to Bill Bieber and George Gardner at this point.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Welcome, George and Bill. Just put yourself on the record and continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to come and talk a little bit about the history of our workforce development at Dahlin Creek. It's a story that we're certainly proud to talk about. It was a product of a lot of years of cooperation and a lot of years of trial and error and learning. And we just kind of want to take you through the process and some of our results. We're primarily focusing on the human resources aspect of the project.
Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, my name is George Gardner. I'm president of Chulista Camp Services Incorporated. Bill Bieber is operations manager at Dahlin Creek. And now we can go into our presentation.
Yeah, please.
Do we need any other questions? I'm sorry. The work at Dahlin Creek was started by Placer Dome back in 1995 with an agreement with Chulista Corporation, our parent corporation. Chulista is one of the 13 regional corporations, are headquartered in Anchorage, and we belong to that corporation. The Dahlin Creek has a bidder preference for all work being done out at Dahlin Creek, built into the lease agreement. It goes to any subsidiary or joint venture of Chulista's, and it's a 5% preference on bids, and with the stipulation also that maximum shareholder hire will be accomplished, will be sought.
You're George.
I'm George.
1995, Placer Dome at the time entered into an agreement with the Chelista Corporation in regards to starting up a small exploration program. Part of that agreement contained the shareholder hire agreement. And just to put it in, you know, as simple a terms as possible, the agreement states simply that any direct shareholder of the Chelista Corporation, any descendant shareholder, or any spouse of a shareholder would have job preference at the site. And it also went on to say that if these candidates could be trained in a reasonable amount of time, then they should be afforded the opportunity for employment. In 1996, we had a very large program. We constructed a 5,000 foot airstrip, a 60 person camp, when we drilled 90,000 feet of core. And through that process, we also brought along our local hire program, the shareholder hire program. And throughout the year, we realized early on that we had some problems and we had some issues in the development of our workforce and the way that we were trying to develop our employees. So at the end of the year, we put together our statistics. And as you can see, they're not real attractive. And with the 318% turnover rate, we went through some 165 employees to fill 40 to 50 positions. At that point, it would have been very easy for both Placer Dome at the time and Chelista to make some major modifications to the programs, but we didn't. We come together, we went out to the villages, and we interviewed employees that voluntarily terminated. We went to their homes and sat down at their dining tables and asked them, what were some of the issues? What can we do differently at Dolan Creek to help make this a successful program? After doing that, we correlated a lot of the information and we retooled our program, and we started out the following year.
Bill has already talked about this, so I won't go into it any further. After that year, the discussions with the villages, with the elders, with the village representatives, and past and current employees. There was frequent village trips made by Placer Dome and Chelista Camp Services, and the villages surrounding the project were always kept very well updated on what was happening out there, both in terms of good news or bad news. I mean, if it was going to be a slow season of exploration where there was only going to be one drill, or if there was going to be no drilling, Placer Dome still went out with us to tell this to the villages. And this was the start of maintaining an open and honest dialogue with the villages. And one of the principal things about this was that In all of our village tours, there was it was emphasized that there was a zero tolerance drug and alcohol policy, that there would be no drugs or alcohol at the Donlin Creek project, nor would there be any people hired that had drug or alcohol problems. This initially was one of the reasons for our bad statistics the first year, but once it was known by all of the villagers that we and Placer Dome were very serious about zero tolerance, we contributed to an overall sobering of the villagers that were involved in the project.
One of the things that we needed to do in putting together all of our plan of attack for being able to develop the workforce, one of the things that we definitely needed to do is provide an opportunity to learn. We also had to provide the guidance for success, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. One of the other things is the fostering the job growth and advancement. We knew early on that the success of this program is going to rest on how quickly we can move our general workforce into supervisory roles. We had part of our discussions in the villages included some cultural differences between Western and Eastern cultures. So what we understood early into the project is we needed to make sure we got our local supervision in place as soon as we can. The other thing was to provide a total work environment in which our employees can be successful. One of the things that a lot of our local employees expressed was we go out to the villages and we try to target, you know, employees or potential employees that are doing well, you know, highly respected in the region, and we bring them to Donlin Creek, put them in these jobs, they fail and go home, and some of our other employees that see this, they look at that and go, you know, maybe I shouldn't be here. So we had to make sure that we created an environment in which our people could be successful. Some of the on-the-job training that we do, and bearing in mind, we're an exploration program, and all of the jobs that we do are exploration related. Not only that, they're not routine jobs. Their jobs change day to day. And when we get up in the morning, our workforce may be facing different challenges day by day. In 2005, through the whole program and whole process of developing the workforce, in 2005 we came out with the largest program ever at Donlin Creek, and it was 135,000 feet of core drilled, condemnation drilling, geotechnical, and we expanded the baseline environmental program. Through that period, we escalated our workforce up considerably. Almost 45% more employees to do this program. At the end of 2005, here's where our results were. We have over 92% shareholder hire. Our supervisors, at the time I was the only non-shareholder supervisor on the project. Our pre-employment fail rate dropped to virtually nothing. Our random screen fail rate was 5%, which by the way happened to be two contractors. And our employee turnover rate was under 10%. In 2006, we came out with a huge program, bigger than we could have even imagined at the time. We drilled 275,000 feet of core, an additional 30,000 feet of geotechnical. We expanded the camp to 150 person. We had all of the other expanded programs going on at the time as well. We literally doubled the size of our workforce in 2.5 months in order to get this project done. At the end of 2006, again, our rates and our results still were extremely good, and we were extremely happy about it. We quite honestly expected higher turnover rates. We expected higher rates of failures for drugs and alcohol, but it wasn't there. And we believe that a lot of the credit for that came from having an initial core group of employees to help mentor the new employees coming in.
From Chula Camp Services perspective, we employed in 2006 over 200 shareholders, provided over $6 million in wages to those shareholders and employees who continued to improve in all their skill levels. And one of the things that we're looking at is the future. And certainly upon further development, if this does become an operating mine, there will be a great prospect for career employment of all of the people that are out in the region. They developed a strong sense of pride and commitment and community, and what started out kind of in a haphazard fashion with only a little bit of a dream of what we wanted has now become a model for working with indigenous entities and rural Alaska. Here are some of the villages that have contributed employees to the Donlin Creek project in 2006, and understanding that rural Alaska is, as you many of you well know, is cash poor and so dependent upon state and federal not handouts but state and federal monies for being able to survive out there. We are a wholly owned subsidiary of Chilister Corporation and provide mostly shareholders as drillers and helpers, and some of those positions, a lot of them just mostly in rural Alaska. In that capacity, we act as a full-service temporary agency and provide the payroll and the taxes and do all the recruiting and interviewing and hiring. We were incorporated in 1996 because of Donlin Creek, and Chelista and Placer Dome commitment. We provide the remote site catering, camp management services, and now even we have an SBA 8A contract with the federal government providing personnel outside of Alaska. In our catering services, we have we can cater up to 150-man remote site camp. We're continually developing shareholder cooks, helpers, bull cooks, housekeepers on a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off basis. In 2006, corporate-wide, we had over 90% shareholders employed. As far as the drilling is concerned, Bort Longyear was our partner and is our partner at Donlin Creek. Originally, we provided only driller assistance, but over the years, those assistants have been trained and are now, and we now have 10 shareholders that are trained drillers and have shareholder driller assistants working for them. The top driller at the project in 2006 was a shareholder. They work on a 20 days on, 10 days off, 12-hour a day basis. We also cater other remote site projects for oil and gas, road and airport construction, fisheries operations. We now are from Petersburg to Prudhoe Bay. We've done contract work providing remote sites with their support. In 2004, we purchased Mayflower Catering in Anchorage. I don't know if some of you from Anchorage, if you're familiar with Mayflower Catering, it's a 3,000-foot commercial kitchen that provides fine food catering for businesses and events. It gives us an Anchorage presence allows us a chance to use that commercial kitchen to train up new culinary career type employees. Why a joint venture? We've joint ventured with a lot of people, and in fact we are partnering with Barrick Gold. It's a silent partnership, but the partnership has developed out of working with each other and developing the gaining the respect and trust of each other, and we think we've by working together on this over such a period of time we've been able to have that mutual trust, respect, and we hope to want to do bigger and better things.
A lot of times when we do presentations like this, we're always asked, well, yeah, you can manipulate the numbers and, you know, and statistics are statistics, but if you'll indulge us, we actually have faces and families that we apply to our statistics. And one of the things I want to do is make sure that we recognize the two gentlemen here today. Their jobs are more than just hiring and promoting our local workforce. Oftentimes, their moms, their dads, they're the mentor, they're the person that helps with finances, personal finances, and things like that. And the two gentlemen here today really have a lot of credit for the success of this program.
And so, Leonard's here. Leonard?
Yes.
Leonard, what were you doing prior in Antioch?
Antioch, I was working for Mark Air Express until they went bankrupt.
Bankrupt. So you needed a job, and Donnelly got it for you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good for us. And Wisley, yourself?
I was the mayor of Lower Kalispell for about 16 years, and then I didn't have nothing else to do, so I took a little ad with Jalista Corporation in 95 and started working for them in 96.
Yeah, very good. Do you make more with corporation or as mayor?
I think I make more by the thanks that I get from the people that
Yeah, very good. Yeah, very good. Very good. Please continue on. Thank you. Thank you.
One of the things I want to talk about too initially is Leonard Morgan started out with us as a drill helper, and that's basically our entry-level position. And Leonard had worked his way up and supervised most of the other departments, core cutting, camp maintenance, things like that, and in 2005 became the other cross shift for Wasley. Wasley did need days off on occasion, so we moved Leonard up as his cross shift, so he's been the shareholder hire coordinator as well. I'm just going to go through these briefly. These are our purchasing logistics coordinators. Last year, we moved just under 2 million pounds of cargo by air to Donlin Creek. The program this year, we're already pushing 1 million pounds this year. These people are the ones that make sure that stuff is coming and going and purchasing and tracking the accounting. Our paramedic and safety coordinators, Alex and Ricky. Ricky started out as a drill helper. Realized that isn't what he wanted to do the rest of his life, went to school, became a paramedic, and he's now back heading up our medical program. Our lab supervisors, they've been with us again. Memo been with us for almost 10 years. And it's also important to note that all of the people you see here have been with us at least 7 to 8 years. Our drilling coordinators, these are the gentlemen that actually coordinate all of the support efforts for that 30,000 or that 300,000 meter or 300,000 feet of core. They're in charge of crews, day shift and night shift, and they do all of the dirt work on the site. Danny Osdahl is our special project supervisor. Special projects can result from just out in the region doing geotechnical work to special programs, things like that. He's from Kelskag. He's a graduate of the West Coast Training Center down in Seattle, and he came to work for us just shortly after that. Our mobile equipment trainer, Johnny Kalila, he was with the project for 11 years. Quite honestly, probably one of the best excavator operators I've worked with. Our administrative services manager, Angie, she's the one that takes care of all of the office and makes sure that everything's functioning out on site. Our electrical supervisor, Carl Morgan, he's in charge of all of our supervision, all of our electrical needs on site. Our camp counselor, last year we realized that we still needed some help on site. Some of our employees were having difficulties dealing with the alcohol. We had gotten pretty good control over our drug situation, but the alcohol was still an issue. So we hired our own counselor. She's on site. She has a master's degree in substance abuse. And part of what she does on site now is hold regular meetings and regular counseling. But she also goes further than that. She also counsels spouses, stay-at-home spouses in the village, to help cope with the fact that the other spouse is away from home 2 weeks out of the month. And she also starts dealing with helping with understanding finance, work stress, things like that. It's really come a long ways. In fact, next week we have a session. We are sponsoring a session in CACO, which is just out of Russian Mission. It's a five-day session. We have 12 of our employees and spouses attending that. It's the group out of Canada from Alkali Lake. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but this is what they do, and they're coming in, and they're going to do this five-day session for us. Our human resources coordinator, he gets involved now in a lot of the background checks and things like that for our employees. Environmental geologist, Tisha from Bethel. Our administrative assistants, our core cutting supervisors, our geology technicians. We actually have three more than that. Our field supervisor, Joey, again started out as a drill helper and worked his way up, became a maintenance supervisor, and now he basically supervises all of the field activities we talked about. He's really my number two go-to guy on site. Our maintenance supervisors, Mike and Boise, they keep all of our equipment running. Our camp maintenance people, Joe and Philip. And our catering, you can tell by the size of my waistline that we do quite well on the food department. Fostering the local relationships. We do a lot of tours. We're bringing in the elders from all over the region to come in and look at our project, but even more, we bring them in to sit down and listen to some of their concerns and some of their expectations of what it is we're doing out here. All that we've done over the last 11 years is really trying to gear up towards the possibility of Donlin Creek becoming a mine. And we understand that there's a lot of growth yet to happen when it comes to our workforce. But the other thing that we do understand is we have 214 employees currently on our payroll from the region. And that's certainly a good start to the future. In leaving you, we have a saying at Donlin Creek, we do the impossible on a daily basis, and miracles, well, they take a little longer.
Okay, we have time for one 45-second question. Well, number one, as I have a note here, George says that you're retired?
Yes, I'm in the process of retiring, so
yeah, you look more active than retired. We appreciate your coming. Whom else do we have here from Donlin that maybe we haven't recognized? Anybody else from Donlin that we didn't recognize? Was squared away. Okay.
James
Beard. Very good. Very good. Well, if I might, on behalf of both the House and the Senate, say thank you each for Steve, Carl, George, Bill, and others that presented. We appreciate that in the distance you came. And the message I received, I will speak for myself, was that if you're going to have a job in some of the more remote areas, it's probably resource-related in a number of occasions, significant number of jobs. The last presentation from Donlin I got from that maybe some of the best therapy for people is a job. That you have a stake and a pride, and you can make something grow. It can be a training program, and you can create a future. And I can say that in a greater sense, some people coming from other areas of the state and other resource activities, the word I've heard from them almost always is if there's a help and a hope for my son or daughter in the future, it's a job, and it's probably resource related. You, as an industry, perform a great function for us. We appreciate your stewardship of the environment. It's our pleasure to be able to listen to you today, but probably more important, to allow you to have a voice so the state, via the cameras, can hear you, what you have to say, and your successes. My personal view, my professional view as a senator in Alaska, is that if you're successful, regions of our state will be more successful. And for that, we say thank you very much. We're adjourned.